Audio.
A 100 years ago, a rain of nuclear bombs obliterated civilization in a few minutes of blazing horror. It was the end of the world. Doomsday, sky dark. With the first nuclear explosion, the tissue-thin tapestry of civilization was ripped apart. The rule of law was replaced overnight with the somber, draconian edict of survival of the fittest. Cannibals hunted prey, cold hearts brutally raided farms, and slavers seized anybody they could as chattel. Electricity was seldom seen, starvation universal, rape a daily event, death the only known means of escape. This is America in the late 21st century. Welcome to the Deathlands. Cutting Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Nanette Savard, Mark Delgado, and Thomas Penny. Deathlands 52, Zero City. As the swirling mists of the Matrans chamber faded away, the seven people inside the unit tumbled to the cold floor, gasping for breath. In silent agony, the companions lay where they fell, waiting for their tortured bodies to finally overcome the horrid sickness that always accompanied a jump. Almost an hour passed before the first of them was able to stir. A string of drool hung from J.B. Dix's mouth. His wire-rimmed glasses slid from his shirt pocket and fell to the floor as a tremor shook the man.
No more. Dark night. I can't take another damn jump.
Agreed. Don't give a motherless damn if we find any food in this redoubt or not. No more jumps for a while. Win, lose, or draw, this is it.
Fireblast. He had known they were pushing the envelope with 3 jumps in a single day, and now they were paying the price. It felt as if fire ants were eating his guts.
About time.
The albino teenager Jack was lying on his side, fighting to control his rebellious stomach. His pale skin looked even whiter than usual, almost the same color as his long snowy hair. The armpits of his shirt were stained dark with sweat.
Not done. 6 before.
Won't ever again, either.
Christy Roth unbuttoned the front of her khaki overalls to expose a wealth of cleavage. Rivulets of sweat streamed off her lovely face, the woman's fiery red hair flexing and moving as if stirred by secret winds.
Don't exaggerate, Jack. It was 6 in a week.
Dr. Mildred Wyeth leaned against the chamber wall, rubbing the back of a hand across her mouth as if trying to remove an unpleasant taste.
Only we did 3 of those 6 in the same day. That's more than enough.
Agreed.
Resembling a Civil War college professor with his silvery hair and old-fashioned clothing, Dr. Theophilus Tanner lay on the cold floor, savoring the coolness against his cheek, his hands white-knuckled about his ebony walking stick.
I wish this room would stop spinning soon.
For some reason, the jumps hit him harder than the others. Perhaps it was a legacy from the time-travel experiments done to him by the whitecoats of Operation Kronos. Doc didn't know, and for the moment, he didn't care. Every peaceful second brought him away from the debilitating jump sickness and put strength into his body. Grimacing in determination, Dean Cotter forced himself to stand upright, then crashed back down on his ass.
Ow!
The 11-year-old blinked away the hurt pride and began the struggle to rise again.
Stay still, son. Rushing only makes the after effects last longer.
Okay. I'll just lie here on the floor a while.
Disregarding his own advice, Ryan struggled to his hands and knees, concentrating on every move as he struggled upright. His vision was clearing, and he was feeling stronger by the second. Briefly, he wondered if he was acclimatizing to the shock of disintegration. Doc had once theorized that the sickness was actually a person's soul searching for the body so rudely taken away. Foolishness, of course, but the time traveler often talked utter nonsense. Adjusting the patch over his left eye and squinting to focus the right, Ryan glanced about the chamber. The walls and floor were made of a smooth blue material speckled with flecks of gold. He didn't recognize the color combination, so they had never been in this redoubt before. For the millionth time, he wondered why the pre-dark scientists had decided to color-code the redoubts, instead of just putting up signs listing the locations. Just another of the endless ancient mysteries they would probably never solve.
This air tastes flat and smells clean. Whenever we found a redoubt with people, I could always sense things like sweat, food, even sex. I could also make out the hot oil in machines or even the ozone from a nuclear reactor. Here, I'm not picking up any sign of life. The only thing I smell here is desertion.
Terra incognita, albeit an aesthetically pleasing locale.
Speak English, you old coot.
Mildred brushed the long beaded hair off her face. Automatically, the healer started to reach for the canteen at her belt, then stopped. Damn, she had forgotten that they ran out of juice 2 jumps ago. Although, to be honest, none of her herbal concoctions ever seemed to ease their jump sickness much. But the physician was grimly determined to keep searching until she found a combination that worked.
We've never been here before. I know that. I was just...
Look at Flaw! Company!
That jarred everybody awake. Stumbling closer to the teenager, Ryan saw a series of boot scuffs marring the floor, which had gone unnoticed in the aftermath of the multiple jump.
Those are army boots. Triple red people.
Ryan drew the 9mm Sig Sauer pistol from his belt, as the companions drew their assorted weapons.
Are they going in or coming out?
Christie's bearskin coat billowed about the redhead's legs as she walked closer to the door, carefully keeping to one side. Only a fool approached an unknown door straight on.
Seem to be both.
JB retrieved his spectacles and set them onto his bony nose. Unfolding the wire stock of his 9mm Uzi submachine gun, he eased off the safety and slid the selector switch to burst. Now, every time he pulled the trigger, the blaster would fire 3 times in less than a second. More than enough firepower for any conceivable danger.
New or old?
Doc laid his sword stick against the wall to free his hands. With oft-practiced ease, Doc emptied a few pockets and began the laborious process of loading his huge .44 Lamar. The Civil War handgun was a percussion piece, and each chamber in the rotating cylinder had to be purged and hand-charged with black powder, cloth wad, and lead ball, and then a copper nipple of fulminating mercury slid into the notch at the base of each individual chamber before it was ready to fire. Although old and slow, under the control of the gentleman from Vermont, the Lamar was a weapon of mass destruction, fully capable of blowing a man in half. It was cumbersome to reload, but the 9-shot capacity more than made up for that small flaw. Blaster in hand, Jack dropped to a knee and rubbed a finger across the scuff marks.
Can't tell.
The bright fluorescent lights overhead glinted off the 6-inch blue steel barrel of his .357 Colt Python. The hand cannon was almost the rival of Doc's monstrous Lamar.
Maybe old and new on top of each other.
Drawing his Browning high-power pistol, the boy dropped the clip to check the load, then slammed it back and jacked the slide.
Only one way to find out.
Mildred held the strap of her med kit with one hand. The other was full of a checkmate .38 caliber ZKR target pistol. The precision revolver was amazingly accurate over long distances, as many enemies and muties had found out the hard way. Ryan, holstering his hand blaster and sliding a Steyr SSG-70 rifle off his shoulder, worked the bolt to check the magazine inside. Satisfied, he slammed it back, chambering a long 7.62mm round for immediate use.
I'll take point. JB, cover the rear. Dean and Jack, with Mildred and Christie.
Listening for a while, Ryan eased open the door and stepped quickly into the next area, automatically moving to the side to clear the field of fire for the people behind him. The precautions proved unnecessary, as this was merely the standard antechamber to the Matrans room, little more than a ready room for the personnel using the Matrans chamber to check their equipment before a jump. Across the antechamber was a plain door that led to the main corridor of the redoubt, and another to the side made of burnished steel. That caught their attention. Christie covered the men as Ryan checked for booby traps, and JB picked the lock.
All clear. I'll go in first. Everyone else, follow me.
It was a standard military office with an American flag covering one wall. A large steel desk stood beneath it, the top covered with an elaborate communications console. There were a few chairs scattered about for visitors, and a sofa in the corner. This was probably the base commander's office. Taking a position near the sofa, Ryan motioned Christie forward with his rifle, and she opened the door leading to the corridor outside. When nothing happened, she knelt low and took a quick look outside in both directions.
Clear. No sign of anybody.
Leave it open. Doc, go stand guard.
The old man saluted with his sword stick and moved into the corridor, his lama resting comfortably in the crook of an arm. Long blaster in hand, Ryan stood guard while Mildred glanced under the furniture and JB peeked into a corner. Checking behind the door leading into the transmat chamber, Dean saw the usual sign posted there. Entry absolutely forbidden to all but B-12 cleared personnel. It was the same in every redoubt they had ever visited.
Anything in the desk?
JB rifled through a file cabinet. Officers often hid things they didn't want to share inside the locked cabinets, but not this time. Nothing but status reports, correspondence, and shipping receiving manifests. The endless effluvia of the pre-dark military. In triplicate.
Just papers and comp disks so far.
JB checked drawer after drawer. Paper clips, rubber bands. He slammed the last one shut.
Nothing useful.
Walking over to the small wet bar, Jack checked over the array of bottles. Liquor was a good item for trade, and vodka could also be used for cleaning wounds and degreasing weapons.
Some bitch! Look at this!
The others gathered close as he turned, holding a squashed cardboard box in the palm of his hand. The lid was ripped off, exposing the neat rows of red and brass shotgun shells nestled inside.
Army issue. The owners of those boots must have left in a hurry.
And left ammo behind?
JB lifted around. 16-gauge, too small for his 12-bore shotgun, but he pocketed the shell anyway.
Damn good condition. Almost perfect.
Jack agreed as he put the rest of the box into a pocket of his vest.
Air dry.
Or the armory has been recently emptied.
Just what they needed. Another empty redoubt.
No signs of battle, so they weren't attacked. Not directly, anyway. Could have been chased out.
Hoisting the Uzi onto his shoulder, JB checked the radiation counter on his shirt collar.
No reds. Place is clean.
It's clean now. Maybe it wasn't when they departed.
Feeling ill to his stomach, Dean stood firm and addressed his father.
I'm ready for another jump, Dad.
The elder Cotter almost smiled, then reached out to ruffle his son's hair.
First we wreck the redoubt. Jumping is what you do when a plan fails. It's never the plan.
The boy nodded in understanding.
Check the barracks first?
Armory.
Ryan wrapped the strap of his long blaster around his forearm for a better grip.
We're almost as low on ammo as food. With any luck, we'll find something there.
Sure as hell hope so. I'm about 6 shots away from throwing rocks.
Me too.
Why ain't got so many knives?
Doc leaned on his ebony stick, the silver lion's head peeking out from between his laced fingers.
Agreed, my friend. The one great benefit of blades is their complete lack of ever needing to be reloaded.
Heading for the stairs, the companion swept through the corridor in a standard 2-on-2 coverage pattern. At an intersection, Ryan and Christie stopped, allowing Doc and Dean to move past and secure the other side. At the stairs, Doc and Dean stood as anchor while Jack and JB moved up the steps. Mildred followed grumpily along with the others. The landing was covered with trash, MRE food pack wrappings, and empty SIG packs. The bright yellow of an official military notice peeked out from among the refuse, and Ryan speared it with his rifle.
A summary notice of execution for two soldiers who tried to leave the redoubt without proper authorization. The charge is treason.
Probably trying to get back to their families.
Then JB saw the pained expression on Doc's face and stopped talking. The man had been yanked away from his family in 1896 by Ober Project Whisper.
Could have been plain old thieves. Maybe black market runners.
Don't care. Starving. Need fat food.
Continuing up to the next level, Ryan paused before opening the door and tilted his head against a cloth-covered grill in the wall.
Music. Weak and off tune.
Maybe this place isn't deserted.
The door swung open on a long chemical laboratory. The tables were stacked with retorts and beakers in a wild state of disarray, and the wall shelves were stacked with countless bottles of unknown chemicals. A pile of animal cages was filled with tiny bones.
Germ warfare?
Wrong equipment. Don't know what it's for.
Walking through the cold, sterile laboratory, Ryan curled a lip in disgust.
Science rules.
A memory of a prior redoubt returned unbidden, but that had been months ago, at the redoubt filled with Ka's army. This one was stripped clean as a fresh corpse. Leaving the lab, they went past a communications room, and at the end of the corridor found the heavy door to the armory. Behind the vein portal of burnished titanium, the U.S. government had stashed away food and blasters for the troops to utilize after Skydark. Unfortunately for the companions, the redoubts were usually picked clean during evacuation. JB tilted back his fedora.
Maybe we'll find some reloading equipment. Not many folks thought to take those, and I can make enough ammo to hold us for a good while if the tins of cordite are still good. Even make something for Doc.
Smokeless gunpowder will not function in my black powder gun.
Well, if I cut it enough.
And the primers?
There you're out of luck. I can't make those.
Doc touched the cardboard box in the pocket of his frock coat that held the precious copper nipples for his handgun. He was down to 18. Maybe it was time for him to switch to a modern breech loader. He savagely shook those thoughts from his mind. No, that would never happen. Shouldering his rifle, Ryan grabbed the release lever of the vault door and let go instantly.
Cold. The bastard door is freezing cold.
Heavy armored and arctic cold. Gaia, you don't think this might be a deep storage locker?
No. Impossible.
More than likely you are right, my young friend.
Doc reached out to touch the icy metal.
We never found one before.
But if it was... My God, we could find anything in there. Enough food to feed an army for a year. Clothes, medicine, anything, everything.
What's a deep storage?
The term puzzled the boy until suddenly he remembered his father telling him about them over a campfire one night. Or rather, his father had relayed the tales told by the trader. Deep storage lockers were very special vaults designed to protect food and ammo for centuries, not just for a few years like a regular armory. It was to be the Predark government's emergency reserves in case food couldn't be grown outside, or the fighting was worse than ever imagined.
A DS locker. All the equipment needed to rebuild a high-tech civilization from scratch behind one door.
Maybe, maybe not. Let's find out.
Ryan grabbed the lever and eased it downward. The handle resisted his efforts, and it took all of the man's prodigious strength to shift its position until the main lock disengaged. Silently, the massive door swung ponderously open, a hairline crack, pale gases loudly streaming out from the thin opening.
Back!
The companions retreated to a safe distance while the vault disgorged its contents of non-breathable inert gases into the air system of the redoubt. Involuntarily, the physician shivered at the temperature drop. God, she hated the cold. Almost a century ago, she had gone into a hospital for a simple operation. There had been complications, and the doctors had been forced to put her in an experimental cryogenic freezer to try to save her life. Decades later, Ryan thawed her from the living death, her illness mysteriously cured. Eventually, the hissing stopped, and the companions eagerly advanced. Doc and JB grabbed hold of the door and started to pull, while Jack and Ryan waited until it was far enough away from the jam for them to start pushing. Dean and Christy kept guard, watching the laboratory for any suspicious movements. Even when there was no discernible danger, it was wise to stay alert. The Deathlands were carpeted with the bones of people who let down their guard at the wrong moment.
How the hell did they get this thing open in the past? Damn thing must weigh a ton!
Mildred splayed her hands. She wanted to help, but only four people could reach the door at a time.
2 tons by my calculations. Perhaps there's a system we haven't found to mechanically open the locker, or some machine we're supposed to attach that does the work for us.
Like those jimmy things on submarines.
Dean bobbed his head to try and see between the masses of bodies and sneak a peek inside the locker. A deep storage locker could have food in there. Maybe those terrific U.S. Army MRE packs with condensed soup and bread and salt and coffee and nut cake and cigarettes and toilet paper. The companions had found a few items in the past, like the cigs they traded for food to the Sekhmen at different vills, but everything else they kept for themselves. Once there had even been chocolate bars.
That's enough.
The group broke away from the metal slab. The portal was a good foot away from the jam, more than sufficient room for them to wiggle through. It was pitch black inside. Reaching around the jam, Ryan slid his hand along until he found the wall switch. He flicked it on. Nothing happened. Then, a soft, high-pitched humming could be heard, and the ceiling began to strobe with flashes of light that came faster and brighter, until most of the fluorescent tubes in the drop ceiling burst into blinding illumination. Eagerly, the companions shoved their way into the locker. Christy stayed outside to guard the only exit, while Dean shoved a chair between the door and the jam to make sure it stayed open. Faintly, in the background, the ghostly music was heard again, then was gone. The air was still chilly inside the vault, the temperature deliberately reduced to help retard the damage to food and weapons from the passage of time. Their breath fogged before them, the tiny clouds instantly disappearing as the redoubt finally began to pump power into the locker. The vents blossomed into life, a steady stream of delicious warm air wafting over them, battling the centuries-old chill. Then their faces fell. Empty plastic shelving stretched for yards in every direction. Only a few scraps of plastic wrapping lay here and there to show where once thousands of ration packs had been stored. Craning his neck, Doc scrutinized the top shelves. Reaching out, he retrieved 2 clear plastic bottles.
Mineral water.
Mildred inspected the containers for leaks or mold, then added them to her med kit.
Better than nothing.
JB opened a metal bin. Damnation. Even the bedrolls and spare blankets were gone. Following the maze of empty shelves, the companions turned a corner into the main area of the locker. Bare shelves stretched to the far wall, dozens of empty wooden pallets lying on the floor in mute testimony of the vanished cornucopia.
Nothing. Not a bastard thing left.
On the contrary, sir. Over here is a collection of office supplies. Yes, indeed. Fax, paper, and staplers are extremely useful nowadays. Shall we each take an armload, or ferry them out one at a time?
Nobody even bothered to comment on the snide remarks. All of their hopes had been pinned on finding something in storage. The last few redoubts had been emptied like this one.
Hey, what's this?
JB peered behind a cabinet slightly angled away from the frosty wall.
Never found a second door before.
Snapping his fingers, Ryan pointed about the room. The companions moved into defensive positions as the Deathlands warrior holstered his pistol and unslung his long blaster. They had once found sentinels hidden in the redoubts, armed robots designed to protect the military bases from exactly what the companions were doing. JB extended the wire stock of his Uzi and nestled it into his shoulder for greater stability.
If it's one of those tin cans, aim for the mouth. Once it's down, we can chill the machine easy.
Holding his Lamar pistol firmly in one hand, Doc grabbed the hammer and pulled back until it clicked solidly in place. The big bore blaster was deadly at close quarters. The soft lead mini-ball would hit like a sledgehammer. Ryan glanced at the others and held up 3 fingers. They nodded. He took a breath, counted to 3, and threw open the door, diving to the side. Everybody paused, braced for an attack, as the door hit the wall with a crash. Only darkness was beyond. The light streaming in from their side illuminated only a small section of the concrete floor. Rummaging in her med kit, Mildred unearthed her old battered flashlight and squeezed the handle a few times to charge the battery inside the handle. The survivalist tool was a recent acquisition for her, a precious find, but was unfortunately already starting to show signs that it was dying. It took more and more squeezing to get the light to work, and the weak beam was taking on a more pronounced yellowish tinge, marking the end of its service. The physician had a single spare bulb as a replacement, and then it was back to oil lanterns and candles. She played the feeble beam about in the darkness, illuminating nothing. Then suddenly, there was an audible crackle of electricity, and the room beyond exploded with light as banks of halogen bulbs in the ceiling came to brilliant life.
Eureka! The eagle has landed!
The tiny room was full of gun cases and ammo boxes, piles and piles of them. Rows of lockers lined the back wall.
Excellent! There has got to be food here!
Mildred started forward, but then abruptly stopped, knowing that J.B. would first have to move among the boxes and crates looking for booby traps, his expert hands touching nothing but caressing the air, as if deciding where to lay the traps himself.
Clear! Come and get it!
Shouldering his weapon, Carter whistled for Christy and Dean to join them as the others converged on the supplies, ripping open boxes and cases in grim concentration. Christy appeared in the open doorway behind them.
What was this? Somebody's private stash?
I don't know.
Jack placed aside a box full of claymore mines.
Dean, look for Grenz.
The boy rushed forward.
On it!
Sliding his Uzi out of the way, JB went straight to a wall locker and began to rearrange the boxes inside. He figured this had to have been the stash of a Navy SEAL or a Green Beret team. They were military-style disposable garrots, the kind that locked once you pulled them closed and couldn't be opened or removed without a knife. Excellent stuff. He hadn't seen the likes of this in decades. Under a pile of flak jackets was a flat box lined with screw-on acoustical silencers for U.S. Army Colt 45 pistols, but no pistols. However, there was an unlocked steel box the size of a shoebox, packed with oily cloths and a good dozen Ruger 44 Derringers. Very illegal blasters in pre-dark days, and he wondered how the base commander got his hands on them. A squat red plastic box bearing the emblem of the Air Force contained a Very pistol and some flares. Useless. On the next shelf down, he found a collection of what resembled wax-covered bricks. But under closer inspection, they proved to be ammo boxes, the cellophane wrapping under the layer of wax still intact. Triple sealed, he marveled. The ammo would be in perfect condition. There was a good assortment of the standard calibers, but no 44 rounds for the Derringers. Damn.
Hey, Jack! 357 ammo!
JB tossed the teenager a box. The albino teen made the catch, shoved the box into the hip pocket of his fatigue pants, and went straight back to his search for explosives. Ryan looked up from a stack of crates covered with shrink wrap.
Any 9mm?
The military markings on the crates identified the contents as light anti-tank weapons, such as a 75mm single-shot disposable bazooka called a LAW. It was the deadliest handheld weapon in existence during its day, and even more so in the present. JB rummaged among the boxes.
Yep, 9mm regular and parabellum.
I'll take those.
Ryan filled his pockets with the spare ammo.
Any clips?
Lots, but just for cold autos. Nothing for a 9.
Christy walked around a 50 caliber machine gun on a tripod.
Any 38s?
Not yet, but I'm still digging.
Lifting an empty grenade tray off a stack, he found only more empties underneath.
Crap! They took all of the implosion grenades.
Ryan dusted off his hands.
Wouldn't you?
The armorer gave a half-smile.
Yeah. Still annoying, though.
Mildred shoved away a big box stuffed full of a coiled ammo belt for a 50-caliber machine gun. If they still had the Leviathan, this would have been a major find. But now it was dead weight.
What about food packs?
No MRE packs. Not even a box of K-rations. Just ammo. Hey, Christy, I found your 38 bullets. Here you go!
I have located a stack of MRE crates over here. Empty, as expected.
Damnation!
Agreed, madam. Agreed. We cannot eat blasters.
Or a halfler.
Jack tossed aside the canvas tarp from a stack of canvas backpacks. Each pack was stuffed with 6 elongated tubes strongly resembling a law, except for a fluted nose and different markings on the pipe.
What are they?
A sort of law rocket, only loaded with napalm instead of high explosives.
Jack dropped the tarp.
Phew. Trade month eaten for one of these.
Shifting through the empty boxes, hoping to find a few packs missed, Doc paused to smile at Jack's verbal outpouring. For the Cajun, that was a long speech.
Leave them till later. We don't know if there's a Ville within walking distance outside.
Be just the thing to convince a stubborn baron we mean business.
True, but for the moment we have no need of them.
As the others ripped through the military stash, Doc gave up his search among the MRE crates and started to check the back areas of the room. According to the trader, the U.S. government had stocked the redoubts with the idea in mind that there was no telling how low civilization might fall after the nuke war. When the troops emerged, they might find savage cannibals wearing wolfskin breech clouts and armed with wood clubs roaming the streets of New York and Chicago. So aside from clothes, medicine, wags, fuel, weapons, and the like, the trader claimed there were also very basic supplies, plows and seed, swords, crossbows, and black powder weapons, to help rebuild America from the ashes. In a corner, Doc found a large, unmarked trunk and smashed off the padlock with the butt of his pistol, then was forced to rip away a plastic tape running along the edges of the trunk, doubly ensuring it was airtight. Lifting the lid, Doc dodged the exhalation of inert gas and then gazed inside with unabashed glee. The top tray was full of luxury items for trading, packs of chewing gum, cigars, butane lighters, hairbrushes, and boxes of condoms. Lifting that aside, he found strings of cheap beads, fake jewelry, and plastic mirrors. Pure tosh, a nice antiquarian word from his grandfather's time, meaning utter and complete crap. So the pre-Dark government had also included trinkets to bribe the simple natives, eh? It was embarrassing to think that whole nations had been stolen with such trash. Underneath the junk tray was a third filled with bundles of bowie knives, crossbows, and quivers of arrows. Better, but not quite what he needed. However, the bottom area contained tiny kegs of black powder, cotton wadding in plastic jars, lead bars and balls for ammo, and a collection of muzzle-loading pistols, huge 75-caliber horse pistols with flint firing mechanisms. Doc knew from experience that he could utilize the black powder, wadding, and lead in his own Lamar. Then, with a cry of delight, he unearthed a tiny cardboard box of copper primer nipples and a brace of Remington muzzle-loading revolvers. They were the standard 44 caliber, exactly the same as his hog-leg Lamar, but heavily gilded with swirls and filigree. Choosing carefully, Doc filled the leather pouches on his ammo belt with more powder and shot than he'd seen in years.
Hey, Doc! Found a brand new Webley 44. She's a beauty. Want to upgrade from that Civil War museum piece of yours?
Standing slightly off balance with the unaccustomed weight of a full pack, Doc turned to grin widely with his oddly perfect teeth.
What? Never. It is impossible. Unthinkable. However, I sincerely do appreciate the consideration, old friend.
Watching the exchange, Ryan draped a bandolier of five-shot clips for the Steyr across his chest.
Reminds you of home, doesn't it?
Fondly, Doc stroked the carved wooden handle of his massive weapon.
Indeed it does. And more. In its own curious way, this is my home.
Ryan understood. Both weapon and man were from the 1800s. To Doc, it was a direct physical link to his family. As dead as ashes now, but still living in another time. The old-style blaster helped keep them alive in his mind. Pragmatic as always, J.B. shrugged in response and went back to his hunting. Dean holstered his Browning and lifted an oddly shaped blaster into view.
Hey, what's this?
It was an angular rectangle with a thick holding grip on top and a pistol-like grip on the bottom. A safety switch was on the left, and a fire selector on the right. Aside from the muzzle, there didn't seem to be any other openings in the weapon.
Heckler and Koch G-12, 4.7 mm caseless. You used to have one of these, didn't you, Dad?
Ryan looked up from unpacking the Haflorockets.
Yeah, I did, although a slightly different model. And it's a damn fine blaster. Holds 100 rounds and weighs next to nothing. Put a hole through a flak jacket at 500 yards.
Curiously, Dean turned the weapon over and upside down.
There's no ejector port.
That's because no brass comes out. The ammo is caseless, like it says. There's only propellant and lead in the stock, no brass. That's why it's a lightweight.
The boy looked at the sleek blaster, impressed. It sort of reminded him of the laser weapons they had faced on Wizard Island, except that it didn't have a dial to adjust the burning power of a beam.
Why did you stop carrying it if it's so great?
I have the Steyr, which has a longer range, and ammo is easier to find. And I can save the brass and do reloads if necessary. The HK can only be reloaded with blocks of caseless ammo, nothing else. When you're out, that's it. She's dead weight.
Getting the balance of the odd rifle, Dean tried the weapon at port arms, then shoulder arms, like he had seen pre-dark soldiers do in the videos the redoubts sometimes had.
I like it.
He slung the blaster over his shoulder. The elder Cauter came over and placed it in his hands.
Okay, then I'll teach you long-range tactics. The Browning is good, but only at short distances. Keep this on the first setting, single shot. One trigger pull fires one round. The next is burst, one trigger pull three rounds, damn near instantly. Sounds like a single round firing.
Wow.
Last setting is full auto. The HK fires fast, 6,000 rounds a minute.
Impressed, Dean raised both eyebrows.
This would empty in seconds.
So stay on single shot, remember that. Reloads fast, but you've got to keep the ammo block sealed and plas until just before you slide them in. The block gets wet, it's dead.
He released the catch on the stock and lifted up the top of the magazine.
When you're done, there's nothing inside to dump, and no spent brass to collect or get underfoot. You drop in the new block, close the top, and go.
You sure know a lot about this gun.
Mildred appeared at the doorway, her expression a mixture of disappointment and anger.
Nothing to eat. We have enough weapons to stage a war, but there's not a single scrap of food here.
Ryan looked over the assemblage of his friends, noticing how thin they were becoming, faces haggard and belts tightened. Short rations for a month had turned them into skeletons.
Okay, everybody load up on ammo. First we'll do a wreck of the base to make sure we're alone, and then we go shopping. There has to be some supplies here, or something edible Mildred might have overlooked.
In perfect synchronicity, his stomach loudly rumbled as he started for the exit.
Let's go find them.
Fully armed, the companions started at the bottom level and worked their way upward. Reactor room, maintenance, offices, barracks were deserted. Not a sign of life, not even a mouse seemed to have breached the integrity of the underground bunker. On the level above the biolabs, they found a communications room with a CD player still struggling to play ghostly music over the intercom system. This was what Ryan had heard earlier. There was no jewel case for the worn disc, and so whatever the distorted tune actually was would remain a mystery. But at least they made the eerie noise stop. Oddly, the music had added a touch of life to the redoubt, and now it seemed even more deserted than before. Unfortunately, the kitchen was devoid of anything edible. The big freezers deactivated and empty as the pantry. Resting a boot on the seat of a molded plastic chair, Ryan glanced over the rows of long tables lining the cafeteria. The one positive aspect was that life support was starting to react to their presence, and the water pumps were coming online. The kitchen taps spewed forth trapped air at first, then brownish gunk, unfit to wash a corpse in, and finally, cool, clear water. It wasn't much, but they took it as a positive omen. Moving to the top floor, the companions found the garage equally devoid of useful items. Bits and pieces of vehicles lay scattered about, but none were in working condition. Heaps of trash were everywhere, string and paper and packing material, along with numerous crumpled cardboard boxes. The others moved about the huge room, giving it a quick once-over. JB headed directly for a battered Hummer near a workbench. The tires were flat, its headlights busted, and the hood was up, exposing the partially disassembled engine. Tools lay on the block, and tiny boxes holding new spark plugs were stacked on the bumper.
Old plugs have never been removed.
He wiggled a hose and tried yanking an insulated cable free, without success.
Engine is still sealed.
Think we could get it working again?
Machines were Dean's passion, and he could never ride long enough in any vehicle. The boy was still irked that he had never gotten a chance to drive the Leviathan before they were forced to abandon the giant war wag. Jack surveyed the other wrecks.
No problem fixing. Tires from that. Headlights there.
What about the battery?
JB pointed out to Dean the shielded box under the hood.
That's a nuke battery. Those babies last forever, and have enough juice to fry a grizz bear, so be careful.
The boy swallowed hard.
Yes, sir.
JB bent over the radiator and started to fiddle with the distributor.
Find me a 3/4-inch combination wrench, will you?
Sure.
Hold on there. It would take hours, if not days, to get that junk pile into shape. Let's wreck outside first. Might not be needed. A bill may be only walking distance away.
Extracting himself from under the hood, JB laid aside the distributor cap.
Fair enough. No sense doing work if it isn't necessary.
Leading the way toward the exit tunnel, Ryan passed one of the many busted boxes scattered about and nudged it with his boot to shove it aside. The sagging side split asunder, and a wealth of tiny cylinders came tumbling out.
I'll be damned.
The labels on the cans were badly faded, but still readable.
Hash! This is corned beef hash! Dozens of cans! Enough for months!
Across the room, Mildred spun about.
Excellent!
Dropping the power drill he had been inspecting, JB hurried over at a lope, with Dean and Jack at his heels. Doc and Christy walked over at a more leisurely pace. Grabbing a can from the pile to show them, Ryan's own elation faded when he saw the side and tops of the container bulging from massive internal pressure.
Oh, damn it! They're spoiled.
Ryan dropped the container as if it were unclean on the outside.
Probably why they weren't taken along by whoever cleaned this base out so efficiently. God alone knows how long they've been lying there.
The rush slowed to a walk, and the companions gathered around the deadly food, the happy smiles gone as quickly as they came.
There's so much, though.
The memory of what pan-fried hash tasted like surfaced in her memory, and she savagely killed the recollection. It was bad enough looking at the stuff without remembering how good corned beef was. Swallowing twice to clear his mouth, Jack felt his stomach churn at the mere sight of the cans.
All bad?
Ryan nudged another box with his boot, and more rounded cans spilled across the floor.
Seems to be. One mouthful of this could chill an army.
Kicking apart another box, JB sent cans rolling across the cold floor of the garage in every direction. He stopped one flat.
Shit!
The thick contents gushed out like speckled mud, the salty meat streaked with vile greens and blues. That killed his anger and his appetite at the same time.
Maybe we could boil the cans without opening them first. You know, to kill the germs and stuff inside.
It would still be deadly. Toxicity is also a chemical composition, not just a bacteriological infection.
Oh. Nothing we can do to fix them?
I'm afraid not, son.
JB threw an old tarp over the boxes and cans.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Christy put some distance between herself and the rotting meat. The stench was ghastly, worse than the breath of a Louisiana vampire.
Mildred, how much do we have?
6 cans of beans and 1 pound of rice. Enough food for 2, maybe 3 days.
Mildred reported this stolidly, the meager weight of her backpack not very reassuring.
After which we start boiling our belts.
Huh?
Remember that leather is edible if cleaned sufficiently.
Ryan surveyed the redhead in her bearskin coat.
We could stay alive off the soup that fur would make for at least a week.
I'm not hungry enough to eat my clothes just yet.
Come on, let's check outside. Been a while since I've been hunting.
Moments later, the companions reached the door to the redoubt. Twice the height of a man, and wide enough to allow a tank passage, the titanium steel was as perfect as the day it rolled out of the foundry. Nothing encountered could even scratch the resilient material. Ryan tapped in the access code on the armored keypad. There was no lever, and obediently the portal rumbled aside, exposing a dark tunnel.
Well, that's odd.
Christy squinted into the darkness.
Looks handmade.
Let me check it out.
JB removed the rad counter from his shirt collar and pointed it toward the opening.
Got no readings.
Mildred dug a tiny wristwatch from her backpack.
Make sure the counter is working properly.
The mechanism was long broken, but that wasn't why she still kept the timepiece. The physician held it out, and JB waved his rad counter over the watch. The counter gave off a click when waved over the tiny, radium-lined hands of the watch.
Okay, let's go. Standard positions, single yard spread.
As they walked into the tunnel, the huge door rumbled shut behind them, loudly bolting closed with a series of dull mechanical thuds. Lighting a few candles, the companions proceeded along the rocky tunnel. The passageway was clearly artificial, the rough walls supported by concrete columns set at regular intervals. The tunnel curved gently to the left, and suddenly their way was blocked by something huge and leathery, the object barely visible in the flickering candlelight.
What is that? A pile of luggage?
Instantly, the obstruction turned and snarled loudly, inhuman eyes dominating a misshapen face.
Muti!
Ryan drew his blaster and started firing. JB brought up the Uzi, the muzzle blasts strobing the passageway in flashes and giving them a brief glimpse of wings and a fang-filled mouth on the end of a serpentine neck. Screaming and spitting in rage, the beast jerked at the impact of the 9mm rounds, then advanced toward the humans, seemingly unaffected from the lead and steel coming its way. Now they all discharged their blasters, the noise almost deafening in the tight confines of the shaft. Then, a thunderous boom overwhelmed the irregular barrage as Doc unleashed the Lama, a foot-long lance of flame extending from the muzzle. Though Doc missed the target, the beast wailed in pain at the sound, covering its gnarled features with both wings. Then, turning tail, it rushed away from the companions and disappeared. Staying in combat formation, Ryan and the others moved forward slowly until reaching the end of the tunnel. A soft breeze threatened their candles, and the companions cupped hands around the tiny flames. The underground passage fronted at the crest of a low hillock, the ground gently sloping away into the night. Overhead, a full moon was struggling to send grayish light through a heavily clouded sky. Not a star was visible, but they did spot a tinged figure flapping for the horizon, as if running for its life. As they walked farther out, the friends watched where they stepped. In the cracks of the stone flooring, a single small flower was growing, the delicate white petals spread wide to challenge the world. JB tracked the passage of the beast with his Uzi, just in case it returned.
Some sort of bat, I think. Ugly bastard.
Ryan scanned the ground.
Don't see any blood. Our blasters did as much damage as pissing would.
Did you see those eyes?
Mildred clutched her ZKR pistol in her hand.
Solid black with no pupils. Definitely nocturnal.
Night feeder. Didn't smell spore. Not home.
Just waiting for prey, like a vulture sitting in a tree.
Ryan rested the stock of the Steyr on his hip.
This is a good vantage spot. Probably can see for miles in the daylight. Look over there.
The windswept dunes of the desert below formed gentle ripples in a flat sandy sea that reached out to the horizon. There stood the ruins of a pre-dark city, a ragged array of skyscrapers reaching into the clouds, proud and majestic. Very few pre-dark cities had escaped the bombs, or the firestorms that followed.
Where are we?
The ruins didn't resemble any metropolis he knew from the past. JB shrugged.
Sky's too cloudy to get a reading with the mini-sextant. Could be anywhere.
Unexpectedly, twin rods of light erupted from the ruins, the beams steadily sweeping across the sky, casting lucent circles on the bottoms of the cloud banks overhead.
Searchlights! I'll be damned!
Maybe just machines. Comp's still trying to fight a war that's been over for a century.
JB checked his cron, then wound the timepiece and returned it to his pocket.
Too irregular. Those are hand-operated.
People?
Jack smiled.
Folks gotta eat.
And we have goods to trade. I would guess it's about a 3-4-day walk from here.
It would only take us a few hours in the Hummer.
JB rubbed the back of Dean's neck and turned to Ryan.
It is fixable.
All right.
Ryan hitched up his belt, a finger feeling the new hole in the strap to make it smaller.
We'll rest up tonight and leave at first light.
It is odd, though. Why would anybody advertise their presence these days? Likely to get you attacked.
Could be throwbacks. Savages still doing a job their great-great-great-grandfathers were supposed to, and now it's a religion to them.
Or a slaver trying to lure in fresh merchandise.
Jack's knife appeared in his hands as if from nowhere.
Maybe cannibals.
Doc scowled.
Great Scott, what a disagreeable notion.
The teenager flipped the blade and tucked it away again. So many questions, and only one way to get any answers. Ryan turned away from the city.
We'll find out in the morning. Come on, we have work to do.
On the far side of the Dead River, the darkness descended upon the Largeville, sealing them in for the night like the lid on an iron pot. Bobbing points of light came from the dozens of bright lanterns held by the Sekhmen patrolling the outer wall, the lamps giving off an odd bluish light from the burning, alcohol-soaked wicks. A stationary series of crackling pitch torches dotted the repaired main streets and the Baron's huge mansion. Closing the wooden shutters on the glassless windows, the blacksmith shut down her forges, letting them cool for the night. The glassmakers did the same, but banked their kiln to keep it warm until the following day. The prisoners assigned to sewer digging were unwrapping the rags from their hands, used in lieu of gloves, and washing the stinking grime of their toils off tired bodies. Behind a barricade of pungee sticks and barbed wire, the Shine Gang ate its dinner and tossed lumps of black coal into the dull reddish fire underneath the huge distillation vat of the still. From the top, the coils of copper angled downward, leading to rows of painfully clean metal barrels waiting to be filled with alcohol for the next day, juice for the vehicles, and fuel for the lanterns, and fuel for the dreaded machine. Murmuring voices came from the patched houses of the full citizens, joining soft conversation from the patched tents of the immigrants yet to be rewarded by full status. The crack of a whip sounded from a three-story building, secreted among the ruins, yet to be reclaimed by the workers. Downtown, happy laughter sallied as a family celebrated the birth of a child. A singing drunk fell to the ground in front of some Sekhmen, who stepped over the man and kept walking. And faint tinkling music drifted out from the well-illuminated gaudy house, set prestigiously between the market square and the barracks of the Sekhmen. But from one tiny oasis came an endless barrage of cursing and grunting. A partially built greenhouse towered above the streets, the framework roof draped in folds of protective canvas. Straining from the load in their grips, two men shuffled away from a huge rock pile, their bare hands desperately clutching a tremendous granite slab.
Easy. Damn it, Jamal. Not so fast. Nearly tripped me. Blow it out your ass, Ben. This thing weighs a ton. Do we have to finish this now? The sec chief says we don't get fed till this wall is up.
Jamal grunted, the smell of dinner a tantalizing torment in the air. He tried not to think about baked potatoes smothered in fried onions with all the mushroom soup he could eat, and failed miserably. The Baron may beat a person at a whim here, but a person was fed.
The first thing they taught me when I arrived here, no work means no food.
Rivulets of sweat running down his hairy forearms, Ben struggled with his grip, the slab of stone shifting dangerously in his slick hands.
Watch it!
Releasing his end, Jamal jumped backward as the stone hit the ground like an earthquake.
Shit!
Ben dropped to the ground and ran his hands over the granite.
Is it broke? Please say no. I can't take another whipping.
Scampering nimbly through the stacks of wood beams and salvaged nails, Jamal returned with the old battered lantern. Standing over the granite, he recklessly turned up the wick, bluish light washing over the deserted construction site.
Oh, it's okay.
He lowered the light to the bare minimum again. This was all the alcohol they would get for today. When it was exhausted, they'd have to work in the dark if that stone wasn't in place. And that was a sure way to lose fingers. There wasn't a man or woman among the crew whose hands weren't covered with scars from the rigors of masonry.
We'll never get this freaking thing in place. Why can't we bust it into pieces?
Baron Strickland wants this greenhouse twice the size of his private one, which means bigger end walls, which means stronger foundations.
He glared hostily.
Unless you want to tell the foreman to go jump a mutie.
And get fed to the machine?
Fuck that.
In the distance behind them, the great beams of the Alphaville searchlights swept the sky in their endless motions, back and forth, a slight wobble every now and then, as a prisoner slowed at his task, and a sec man encouraged him to do better with a lash from a knotted bullwhip. Ben eyed the slab hopelessly.
So what do we do?
Gotta ask for more men on the job.
Jamal sighed, rubbing his lower back.
We'll take a few lashes, but that's better than busting this thing.
Ben shook his head. Another whipping. He was starting to lose feeling in his back from the accumulation of scars. Jamal said the outside world was a lot worse than this place. He was an immigrant and should know. But Ben was born here and couldn't imagine a worse hell than living in Alphaville.
How about we take another rest, try again in a... Never mind. Here comes the answer.
Out of the dark, a huge figure was shambling along the street, moving hunched over as if struggling against a fierce wind. Ben called out with a wave.
Hey, Sarge! Over here!
Shuffling along, Sergeant Harold O'Malley paused and stared at the men with his good eye. Many people, when they first met him, instantly thought him to be a mutie, with his bent back, mottled hair, and distorted features. But in truth, he had been one of the most handsome men in the ville, until he fell through the top of a greenhouse, the shards of glass reducing his good looks into a grotesque mockery in less than seconds. And even worse, a sliver of glass had stepped into his head, producing little blood and healing quickly, but his mind was gone, terminated like a cut cable. All that remained of the master sergeant of the Alphaville Sec Men was a powerful body, forged to even greater strength by the endless toil of brutally hard work. Harold came their way at a leisurely pace, trying to smile, but only managing to distend his lips and drool slightly. In his powerful arms, he clutched a tiny box covered with flowery wallpaper.
What's prob? Bad rock?
Yeah, that's right. It's a bad rock. Toss it on top of the wall for us, would you, pal?
Harold blinked at the titanic stone, as if registering its existence for the first time. A soft wind blew over the worksite, carrying the smell of hot dust from the outer desert. Somewhere, a wolf briefly howled and was abruptly silenced. Harold grinned.
Sure.
Putting aside his package, he started to bend to grab the rock when a song repeated in his addled mind about lifting big things up from the knees. He had to listen to the voices in his head, he admonished himself. They were friends. Bending his knees, Harold slid his thick sausage fingers underneath the rock and grunted slightly as he lifted the quarter ton of polished granite to his chest.
Where?
Open-mouthed, Jamal could only stare as Ben directed Harold to the wall. Gingerly, so as not to hurt the puny wall, Harold placed the slab on top and stepped away quickly. Sometimes when he moved things, they fell over, and he didn't want to get hurt. For a split second, there flashed through his mind a kaleidoscope of images, a ladder, a push from below, falling toward the wall, but then they were gone and forgotten.
Good job, Sarge.
Ben slapped the giant on the shoulder.
Get along. Dinner is waiting.
Yeah.
Tenderly retrieving his box, Harold ambled away, so very pleased to have helped a friend in need. Softly, the voices in his head started to whisper that they really weren't his friends, but he covered his cauliflower ears and shouted until they stopped. Everybody in the ville was his friend. Didn't they always ask him for help? He was as important as the Baron, and today was a special day. He clutched the canvas bundle in his arm even tighter. Harold was going to get married today. Watching the broken Goliath shuffle away, Jamal fanned himself with a battered cloth cap.
Son of a bitch! I ain't never seen nothing like him.
Ben agreed, finding his shirt and pulling it on over his head.
Yeah, strong as a machine, and just as dumb. We get him to do a lot of our work for us.
Doesn't the foreman know?
Nah, he does it too. We all do.
Unwrapping the rags from his hands, Jamal privately smiled at the news. That was important information to file away if he ever decided to rat to the Baron on laziness in the construction crews. Might become foreman himself that way.
If that thing ever goes insane, be mighty hard to stop.
Ben scoffed, reclaiming his own hat, a battered baseball cap with the letters removed from the bill. Only a few loose threads showed where the embroidered logo of some pre-dark company had once been.
A bullet in the head will stop anything.
Jamal scowled deeply and cast his eyes to the cloudy sky.
No, there's some things a blaster can't stop.
Fully understanding what the immigrant was referring to, Ben felt a rush of fear and turned up the wick on the lantern as high as it would go. The area was filled with brilliant light for several yards in every direction.
Come on, let's get inside.
Staying near the lantern, they hurried toward the barracks, and a meal long overdue. The tiny gray house stood alone on a cracked parking lot, the single plastic window solid white from the sandstorms that occasionally swept over the ville from the desert. The roof was tough plastic and withstood the acid rains in the spring just fine. Although kind of small, it had been comfy for two, tight for three, and now was too damn big for just one man alone. When Philip Arnstein and his wife first found the place, there had been a chart posted on the exterior listing the prices for the privilege of parking in the lot. But he had found a rusty can of paint decades ago and used half to paint the exterior twice, giving it a new look that pleased his wife greatly. She had shown him how much that night by doing things she had only hinted about earlier. He still remembered that night, and always would. Naturally, the other half of the paint was given to the Baron. Sex was nice, but not even the wolves scared him as much as the thought of going to the machine. Sitting in a lawn chair by the open door, the old man shook off those thoughts and lit a corncob pipe with a piece of smoldering oakum. In his withered hands was a whole fresh corncob, nicely dried and completely devoid of anything edible. Smoking contentedly, the oldster started to whittle a new pipe. This one was getting a bit oily in taste, and was soon for the mashpot of the brewers. The Baron didn't let anything go to waste. It was his only good point, the bloody bastard. Then, from out of the darkness, a monstrous shape lunged forward, and the old man screamed in fright, dropping his pipe.
Hi, Mr. Arnstein. I got speak about Laura.
Harold was grinning sloppily.
Harold, don't ever do that again.
Arnstein searched on the ground for his pipe. He found it under his chair and lit it with trembling hands.
Damn near made me jump out of my skin. Thought you was a mutie.
Harold tried to sneak a peek inside the tiny house.
Sorry. Laura?
Not here.
Arnstein was surprised he got her name right. Poor dumb thing got lost inside a walled ville. It was pathetic. The new Baron should have shot him years ago out of kindness, but Strickland wasn't exactly famous for his mercy.
Mary. Want to marry her.
He held out a package.
Brought gift. Dowry.
The former sec man stumbled over the big word, and wasn't exactly sure what it meant. But the voices in his head kept screaming it was the correct thing to do. Ask first. Always ask first.
You want to marry my daughter, Laura?
The old man chewed over the pronouncements as if it were unknown meat. Damnedest thing he had ever heard. Why would even this halfwit want to marry a retarded whore?
You fucking her.
Harold felt his face burn bright red, and his vision clouded, dots of blackness swimming before him, like a cloud of flies. Harold remembered how they had once kissed.
Yes. We in love.
Rad blast it. The hunchback and the girl were having sex.
Sorry, son, but you're a day late. She was just too much trouble here, knocking over things, setting fires, so I sold her to the Gaudy House.
Raw horror seized the Goliath, his heart pounding savagely in his barrel chest.
She at bad place?
He grabbed the old man and lifted him effortlessly off the chair. A massive hand closed around Arnstein's neck, cutting off the air.
No! No! I marry her! She mine! You hear me? Mine!
Feebly, Arnstein clawed at the hand holding him aloft. He tried to kick Harold between the legs, but he was too far away, his skinny foot only flailing helplessly.
Baron made me! Everybody has got to work! You know the rules! Same as me! Hell, boy, you wrote them. No work means no food. Or worse, expulsion.
Finally, Harold realized what he was doing and eased his grip. Frightened, Harold glanced at the rusty wall of smashed cars rising above the ville. Outside, the muties would get you. Laura was too little to go there. He could, but he was strong and knew the great secret. But Laura sold to the Gaudy House? Raw fury seized the man, and he felt the adrenaline rush of killing flood his body, when the ghostly voices commanded him to release the white hair. He was Laura's father. Would Laura marry the man who killed her blood kin? Conflicting emotions shook his fragile mind. On impulse, he released the man, as if gesturing in surprise. Harold rumbled menacingly at the man, cowering on the pavement.
Back! You get her back!
Arnstein massaged his bruised throat.
Can't. She belongs to the house now. They own her. Probably already at work doing some sick man or farmer.
The words so simply said hit Harold like punches, driving the madness from his mind, and replacing it with a deadly cold fire. He turned and stumbled, going down the streets between the array of finished greenhouses. His pace quickly became a sprint, then a lope, as he dashed across the ville to save the woman he loved from being forced into kissing other men. The blocks flew beneath his shoes, and the greenhouses passed by in glittering majesty as if crystal phantoms. Reaching the market square, he plowed into numerous people, his every thought on reaching his goal. Music, light, and laughter came from every window and door of the building. A few men lounged against the wall, smiling and smoking on corncob pipes. The front door was garishly painted with a vulgar cartoon for patrons who couldn't read, and the picture fueled Harold into an insane rage.
No!
Charging, he simply plowed through the door, ripping it off the hinges. The crash stunned him for a moment. Then he found himself standing inside the Gaudy House, with a bouncer advancing upon him, brandishing a dented baseball bat.
What's wrong with you, Sarge? You finally gone crazy? I forgot how to knock.
Harold wasn't sure how to answer the man, so he said nothing. Okay, he was inside, but now what? The giant couldn't think. His thoughts were muddled and confused. Looking about hopefully, he saw a group of men drinking at tables in the next room. The walls were covered with mirrors, and a pretty girl with garish makeup stood behind the makeshift counter, polishing a plastic tumbler, her red satin dress skin tight, her bound breasts nearly spilling out for display.
You've been smoking wolf weed?
The bouncer immediately regretted his words as the hunchback stared at him directly, with eyes filled with death.
You're gonna have to replace that door.
No! Where Laura?
She's not here. Pat's in her home.
Was that true? Could it be? Harold felt even more confused when he saw the bouncer glance nervously at the steps leading to the second floor, and some small part of his brain that could still process information told him the man was lying, that Laura had to be up there. Turning, he started for the staircase. The bouncer blocked his way, and Harold shoved him aside. The man flew across the room and landed on the floor with a thud, then picked himself back up cautiously.
Laura! Laura!
She's upstairs with a customer. Wait your goddamn turn. She'll be down in a second.
Screaming in fury, Harold took the stairs three at a time to the upper level. A long corridor stretched before him, lined with doors on each side. He could hear odd noises from the other side, squeaking and muffled cries. Choosing one at random, he kicked it open, the door coming off the hinges and sagging to the floor. Inside, two people were on a bed, wrestling. They froze in surprise. Without comment, Harold went to the next door and tried again. That room was empty, but strange items made of leather hung from the walls and bedposts. He didn't understand, and left feeling oddly unclean. In the room across the hall, Harold found three nude women lying on the bed covers, their limbs entangled to the point where it was impossible to tell where one ended and the next began. He grabbed a random leg and started to separate the moaning women. Each began to scream as he forced their faces upward to see which was Laura. None of them was.
Laura!
Leaving the room, Harold shouted her name again as the bouncer appeared at the end of the corridor brandishing a homemade blaster, a thin metal barrel attached to the wooden grip by baling wire.
Hold it right there, buddy!
He slid a .22 cartridge into the breech of the zip gun. With the other hand, he pulled back a nail attached to a rubber band.
Ain't no fighting on the fuck floor allowed.
Harold's beleaguered mind couldn't comprehend the full meaning of what was said, but he recognized a threat, and panic for Laura seized him worse than before. Finding he still held the broken handle from the first door in his hand, he threw it at the man, catching him in the stomach. The man doubled over, vomiting, and dropped the blaster. The weapon fired as it hit the floor, a puff of dust exploding from the wall near Harold. Not connecting the two events, Harold went unconcerned to the next door and kicked it open to find more people wrestling. A man on top of a woman with raven black hair glared at him.
What the hell is going on here? Scram, Gimp! I paid for this slut. She's mine for another hour.
But as the stranger resumed his actions, Harold saw in horror that it was Laura under him. Her slim arms were tied to the bedposts, her nude body splayed like a cow for slaughter. Her blue eyes were closed, a dirty rag stuffed in her mouth, and Harold's new wife-to-be made little whimpering noises as the big man between her legs began pumping again. Stepping to the bed, Harold punched the man in the face as hard as he could. Blood sprayed from the impact, and the stranger flew off the bed, tumbling to the floor in a tangle of clothes. Looking down at Laura, he saw she wasn't really naked. Her clothes were undone and in wild disarray, her breasts fully visible, and the tangle of ebony hair between her legs exposed. A cold voice came from the doorway.
Don't you move.